to the chase, the Hamilton film has arrived, and it's great. 4 years after Lin-Manuel Miranda's show won 11 Tony Awards, you can watch an original Broadway cast performance at home.
The film is available on Disney Plus. It's a chance to see already legendary performances from David Diggs and Leslie Odom Jr. and others, and to see how this sweeping historical story was staged. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Hamilton on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen, joining us from her home in New York, is culture critic at The Undefeated, Soraya Nadia McDonald. Hi, Soraya.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me again.
It's delightful to have you here as always. So this is a recording that was done of the stage production in June of 2016, shortly before the original cast kind of started to break up and leave. This was around the time that it won all these Tonys. They sort of locked it away as the production was touring. Now it's on Disney Plus. You'll remember that Stephen and I, along with other members of the PCHH team, saw the original Broadway cast in March of 2016. Soraya, this is your first time seeing the stage version, although you are a devotee of the cast album.
Yeah.
Stephen, it's safe to say you and I were both very pro-Hamilton when we saw it in 2016. How did you feel about this translation of it into film?
I was thrilled to revisit this production. You know, I went into seeing the original cast of Hamilton without really having spent a lot of time or really any time with the cast album. I kind of wanted to go in cold. And so when I saw it originally, I was just dazzled by it, but I was learning as I went along. And in the years since 2016, I've listened to the cast album conservatively 100 times. And so I have like every word of Hamilton kind of etched into my brain, so that now going back and rediscovering what it was like to watch this cast work this stage with these songs, it gave me a fresh feel for the material. And I was really struck, watching it on TV is a different experience from watching it on stage, because when you're watching it on stage, everything that's happening on stage is happening all at once. And so in one corner of the stage, you see, oh, King George is actually in this song. I didn't realize that from listening to the cast album. But you're then not seeing maybe the central action. You're not seeing the look on the face of Leslie Odom Jr. as he's singing a certain song. Watching the film, you're getting kind of what you're supposed to be seeing. The director, Thomas Kail, is kind of fixing your focus where it's supposed to be. And so there were so many details from this production that I did not remember, did not know. There are sight gags that I missed or had forgotten about. We won't give away every sight gag, but there's in the wedding of Alexander and Eliza, you see the procession work down, and then all of a sudden, Hercules Mulligan is the flower girl, and he just like throws a little tuft of flower petals in the air, and it's just this half a second bit, and you just laugh your head off and move on to the next thing. So there is something for you, even if you have memorized every second of the cast album, even if you have seen this original cast on Broadway, there are still things for you that are new in watching this production.
Yeah, Soraya, you are a theater critic, which is something that neither Stephen nor I normally are. I would expect you to be more attuned than perhaps we would to whatever is changed between the experience of a theatrical show and watching a film of it. How did you feel about how they did this translation?
You know, one of the first things that I realized was just how much I miss live theater, because I haven't been to a theater in 3 months since March because of the pandemic, obviously. And just even hearing like the audience clapping or laughing or just reacting at certain parts, it was just, oh, like it's so nice to be able to feel like you're experiencing something with people as opposed to just alone by yourself. But the other thing that stood out to me was I had to sort of remember that, like, I'm not in control, you know, because when I go and I see something in a theater live, it's very much like my gaze, right? Because I'm deciding sort of what to pay attention to as everything is happening on the stage at the same time. And you can't do that here. You sort of have to submit yourself to what Tommy Cale is like, okay, focus on this, right? And he's very good at that in terms of looking at people's facial expressions. And that's something you don't necessarily get. You know, if you are in, say, like the last row of the mezzanine at Richard Rodgers Theater, you know, even with opera glasses, maybe you're not going to pick up on some of those sort of more minor details that come shining through when you have a filmed production like this. It's a very satisfying television experience. You just have to remember that, like, these two things are going to be sort of discrete and different experiences, and that's okay.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting to me because I came away feeling like this film is a very different experience from the cast album and a very different experience from the live performance for all of the reasons that you're both talking about. That the benefit of the live performance is that you can see everything at once. And as Sarai says, choose where you want to put your focus. The difficulty of the live performance, as Steven says, is everything is sort of given the same weight. And therefore, you don't see anything in particular detail necessarily. And if it happens once and you miss it, then it's done, which is one of the things that makes live performance precious and wonderful. And all of those things are true. One of the things that I took away from this was the performances, particularly the David Diggs performance, I think. Although he's wonderful on the cast album, and that is a wonderfully energetic performance on the cast album, there is a rawness to the performance on stage. It's a little bit different. And I queued up two clips of My Favorite Thing in the World, which is his entrance as the Marquis de Lafayette in Guns and Ships. And first, I want to hear the way it sounds on the cast album. We're going to hear it's one of the best parts of the show. Here's David Diggs on the cast album doing that entrance in Guns and Ships.
Everyone give it up for America's favorite fighting Frenchman! I'm taking this horse by the reins, making red coats weather with blood stains. And I'm never going to stop until I make a drop, I burn them up and scatter the remains down. Watch me engaging them, escaping them, and raging them out. I go to France for more fun, I come back with more guns.
And so here is how that exact same thing sounds in the live film on Disney Plus.
Everyone give it up for America's favorite fighting Frenchman! I'm taking this horse by the reins, making red coats weather with blood stains. And I'm never gonna stop until I make them jump up and I'm up and scatter the remains out. Watch me engaging them, escaping them, enraging them out. With the raps for more fun, I come back with more guns.
So in that live performance, it's more raw. It's more of a shout. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the way cast albums are. The cast album is trying to capture the most precise and musical interpretation of the song. The live performance is, and you can actually also hear it just in that little bit of Leslie Odom Jr. when he yells, "Everyone give it up for America's favorite fighting Frenchman." It's more of a shout in the live mm-hmm. performance than it, even though it's at top volume in the right. cast album, it's more raucous in the live performance. I also noticed that there are places, and this is obviously particularly interesting in the case of a musical that's so full of hip hop and rap, the treatment of the beat in the live performance is a little more flexible. They bend around the beat a little more, whereas mm-hmm. the precision of the cast album is the focus. And you hear it just kind of now and then, they're a little more ahead of the beat or behind the beat in a way that's all very intentional, but it's different from the cast album. And Soraya, you're nodding, and I'm anxious to hear what you're thinking.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm reminded of something that I heard actually when I attended a performance of Slave Play, and Jeremy O'Harris, the playwright, was there afterwards to do a talk back. And one of the things he was saying is sort of the farther you get into the run of a production, the more it becomes the product of the actors and the company as opposed to the playwright. You know, we see that too with Hamilton, where you're talking about actors maybe being a little behind the beat in their delivery. You know, the other thing that I find myself appreciating is David's just magnetism and like utter charisma, because he's really sort of the true villain of this musical, to the point that like he comes between Burr and Hamilton, but he's so charming. Ugh. He's just so much fun to watch, even though he is kind of a turd, right? But he is, that guy who's like arrogant, and yet you still just kind of want to pay attention to him anyway. One of the other performances that I found myself really appreciating more than I did when I was just listening to the cast album is that of Oka Naudowan, who plays Hercules Mulligan and James Madison. And like a big part of that is just sort of his physical presence. You know, he's tall, he's very sort of broad shouldered and like strong, which is just hilarious to me, particularly in the parts when he's playing Madison, who is just so famously diminutive. You know, he's known for being very sickly. And then you have like this strapping man, you know, who's adding in these little asides or phrases, but also like he functions as a hype man. You know, if this is a hip hop musical, then Hercules Mulligan is the hype man, right? And so even when he's in costume in this sort of colonial garb with the buckled shoes and the tights and the breeches and everything else, he is allowed the one anachronism in terms of wardrobe, you know, because he's got that Scully cap that he's always wearing, right? Because he is the guy who like always goes hard. That's Hercules Mulligan.
Yeah, I agree completely. I also found that watching the production versus listening to the cast album, you get a little bit more layers to some of the characters that feel a little underdeveloped on the cast album. I think Philippa Sue as Eliza can come across on the album just as a little bit of a noble sufferer. And Linda and I have talked about this a number of times. The character of Angelica isn't really quite done justice by this story. Angelica has a number in kind of one of the original drafts of Hamilton called Congratulations that does more justice to her. And watching it as opposed to listening, you still don't have that number, but you get a little bit more of a feel for who these characters are as women. And I think there's a very important touch, like watching Philippa Sue's Eliza. When Philip does that little rap, "My name is Philip, I am a poet," she's beatboxing.
Mm-hmm. Philip, take it away.
Daddy, daddy, look. My name is Philip. I am a poet. I wrote this poem just to show it. And I just turned 9. You could write rhymes, but you can't write mine.
And it's very silly and light and fun, and you just get a sense of how well-rounded that performance is beyond just vocally and beyond just in terms of she goes through these terrible things and it's sad.
I still find, you know, some of the issues about the women in the show kind of frustrating, but I do think they are done more justice by this. And I think you're right that it brings out new elements of the characters. And the other one that I would mention, and I could talk for an hour and a half about how much I love Leslie Odom Jr. in this show, but I think it brings out an edgy funniness in that performance that I think on the cast album, he can seem very, very earnest. And there is such a blend of this kind of intentionally grinning, almost slightly hyper way that he tells this story. Because really, and I wrote about this in the piece that I wrote at NPR, one of the things that took me a long time to realize is that just as David Diggs is playing, you know, both Jefferson and Lafayette, just as Anthony Ramos playing both Lawrence and then Hamilton's son, Philip, Leslie Odom Jr. is also really playing two roles in this. He's playing the contemporary Burr at the time that all of this is happening, but he's also really got that pulled back, like the leading player in Pippin or like the narrator in Into the Woods, a kind of perspective. And I think on the cast album, it's so easy to be blown away by the delivery of those bravura songs. He has such a funny, pointed, more interesting and complicated humor to the way that he's playing Burr than I think you always get if you just listen to it.
You are seeing some theatrical acting. You are seeing some big mm-hmm. face acting
yeah.
that you're obviously not getting on the cast album. And I think particularly in Lin-Manuel Miranda's crying, uh-huh. you're getting a little bit more acting than you maybe needed to see. I would say that is one of the few faults I would find in this is like,
I agree.
Boy, that looks different from what you would want it to look like. And also, I do think, you know, much has been made in the weeks leading up to the release of this film that two F-bombs are distorted in the soundtrack because this is, they wanted this to be PG-13. They wanted this for Disney Plus. So you don't get Hercules Mulligan, When You Knock Me Down, I Get the Back Up Again. And you get In Washington on Your Side, Southern Democratic Republicans, which is one of the most cathartic line readings you will hear. Like,
yeah.
And I found the scrambling in particularly in Southern Democratic Republicans, boy, it's a loss.
You know, it says something about sort of the precision and just purposefulness behind Lin-Manuel's songwriting that even if it's just one word or two words that are taken away, you really notice. You know, the other thing that you notice sort of as the show progresses and moves along into Act Two and then even further, you know, once you're after the revolution, is that in some ways it becomes much more kinetic. The emotions become bigger. And one of the places where I notice this is Say No to This. So when you've got Lin-Manuel as Hamilton, you know, one of the things about that song is that he's basically, you know, he's sort of being wooed and seduced by this very sensual Mariah Reynolds, played by Jasmine Cephas-Jones. He doesn't give me quite as much as I would like him to in terms of that sort of nervous energy that sort of carries over into, okay, I'm going to say yes to this.
And I said, well, I should head back home. She turned red. She led me to a bed, let her legs spread and said, hey, hey, hey. That's when I began to pray, Lord, show me how to say no to this. I don't know how to say no to this, but my God, she looks so helpless, and her body's saying hell yes.
Whoa, whoa.
It just makes me wonder and wish that I had seen Javier Muñoz as Hamilton, right? Because he sort of got branded as sexy Hamilton when he took over the role after Lin-Manuel left. You know, maybe Lin-Manuel is the PG-13 version of Alexander Hamilton and Javier is maybe closer to rated R.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also always think about it when I listen to Dear Theodosia because I think Lin-Manuel Miranda is a charismatic performer. Obviously, I think his presence was needed for this show to become what it was. I don't think he's a great singer. And I think when you have somebody like Leslie Odom Jr. singing a very kind of tuneful, beautiful song, and then you sort of have the entrance of this other person where I think singing a ballad like that is not the strength. I always sort of wish that I could experience that with a more balanced pair of singers. And what I had always heard about Muñoz, and I have no idea if this is true, not necessarily as good of a rapper, but a better singer is what I had heard. And so I think those things are all interesting. And the great thing is, like, look, this show is going to continue to exist and be performed. And I do think that this piece is a very good step forward in bringing it to more people. I am sad about the garbled F-bombs, but I'm really happy it's going to be on Disney Plus. And, yeah, and I think it's great that it's out there. And you can see the company and the costuming and all that stuff. And I think that you may enjoy it too. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and let us know what you think about the film. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vrbo. Summer is here and vacation is just a drive away. Search thousands of nearby vacation rentals on Vrbo to find your family a private home all to yourselves, where you can spread out, chill out, and feel that vacation feeling again together. Book the home that makes the vacation. Download the Vrbo app. That's V-R-B-O.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Soraya, Nadia McDonald, what is making you happy this week?
So what's making me happy this week is a novel, but it's also the announcement that it's going to be adapted for HBO. And that novel is Britt Bennett's The Vanishing Half. It's her second work. after she sort of blossomed onto the literary scene in 2016 with The Mothers, which I thought was this really engrossing novel and coming of age story. And one of the things that I appreciate about Britt's writing is just the way that she describes and characterizes and writes female friendships and how special they can be. You know, you have sort of like this sister-like bond, but then there's also something more to it. And so in The Vanishing Half, you know, she's kind of revisiting that. This time it's with twin sisters. It's sort of much more, I think, broad and ambitious in scope, right? Because it spans like several decades from like, I think, the 1950s to the 1990s. You've got sort of this geographical scope because it's you're going from like the Deep South to California. And then also you've got these two sisters who are twins who are African-American, but one of them is able to and does pass for white. You know, she's exploring all these sorts of tensions that arise because of that. And I think I'm also just excited because, you know, someone was like, yeah, let's do this, instead of saying, well, somebody's already got an adaptation of Nella Larsen's Passing in the works. We don't need yet another story about this specific thing. I'm like, yes, yes, let's do both.
Oh, that is wonderful. So that is Britt Bennett's The Vanishing Half. Thank you very much, Sarai MacDonald. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, like a lot of people, I have been spending a good deal of time in quarantine playing board games with my family, also dabbling in the Nintendo Switch. Well, the Nintendo Switch, just about a month ago, managed to combine those two phenomena in a game called Clubhouse Games, 51 Worldwide Classics for the Nintendo Switch. This, for my family, meant a lot of incredibly heated games of Connect Four, which, if you have not played Connect Four in a long time, it is a riveting game. And when you were playing it on your television, you're not doing all that endless cleanup of checkers that have toppled through. Now, of course, they cannot call it Connect Four. They have to call it Four in a Row. I appreciated the fact that in the promotional material, it says this game has gone by quite a few names, including the Captain's Duel. Like, yes, and also Connect Four, which you can't say. It's got your chess and your checkers and your war and your darts and solitaire and dominoes and mahjong and air hockey. It has a bunch of different kind of tank battles, which bring to mind like Atari 2600 combat. You can kind of think of this as like an assemblage of all of like the early Atari 2600 games, but with amazing graphics. It was amazing how much time we managed to get lost in this little collection of goofy kind of mini games. Just the Connect Four alone was worth it. That's Clubhouse Games for the Nintendo Switch.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Clubhouse Games for the Nintendo Switch. I realized this week that I had run out of television. Now, of course, that doesn't mean I had run out of excellent, high-quality, serious television for when I'm trying to feed my brain. It means I had run out of relaxing television. I had run out of things to just have on. I've been binging Antiques Roadshow. Now, how have I been binging Antiques Roadshow? Well, because I hooked myself up with a channel that I got through Amazon Prime called PBS Living.
Ooh.
And I thought, PBS Living, that is what I want. You got all your old Julia Child. You got your actual cooking shows from when they were serious lessons about cooking. But you also have a ton of Antiques Roadshow. Now, I would offer this caveat about Antiques Roadshow. You got to watch out for Antiques Roadshow in the sense that, first of all, if you watch shows that are set in the South, you're going to see a lot of Confederate doodads. Mm-hmm. I typically do not enjoy the Confederate doodads. I go skipping through them pretty quickly. You will also see a lot of conversations with white people who have come into possession of artifacts and things that you think, I don't know if I think you should have this, and I don't care that you got it from your grandfather, because I'm not sure your grandfather should have this. So you do have to watch Antiques Roadshow with something of a critical eye. But a good part of it is things like looking at a piece of pottery and sitting in your house and saying to yourself, $100 or $16,000. I can't tell, but I'm going to try to guess. So that is what is making me happy this week, putting a very critical but still often appreciative eye on the random lottery ticket that is Antiques Roadshow. Available, some of it you can stream on demand regular, or you can stream a lot more of it on PBS Living. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven and Soraya at Soraya McDonald. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you're bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.
Comedian Nicole Byer doesn't consider herself body positive. She just accepts herself as is.
I hate that there's a name for, like, not hating a part of who you are. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's insane.
Nicole Byer on her new book, Very Fat, Very Brave, and How to Love Yourself. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.